The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. Today we'll be taking a break from all the fiction at the Edinburgh International Book Festival to concentrate instead on horses. We'll hear from the godfather of all stuntmen, Vic Armstrong, about his work on everything from Indiana Jones to James Bond, and he'll spill the beans on whether Tom Cruise really does do his own stunts. But first, aside from a predilection for totalitarian control, what connects Hitler, Stalin, and Marshal Tito? The unexpected answer is the Lipizzaner horse, the subject of a new book by the Dutch journalist Frank Westerman. In Brother Mendel's Perfect Horse, he tells the story of an equine breed that became deeply embroiled in some of the most troubling episodes of 20th century history. Here's Westerman reading a section in which he makes contact with one of the keepers of the bloodline.
At the center of the ring that was the world of Lipizzaners stood a Viennese hippologist named Hans Brabenitz. He knew their individual paces, their characters. He did not own a computer. The bloodlines of 5,000 horses were stored in his brain. With his wife, Susie, he could be found in the Vienna phone directory. Pacing back and forth in my office, I practiced three German sentences. Then I punched in the number and explained to Brabenitz, the R, dark and rolling, who I was and why I hoped to speak to him. I also told him that I would be coming to Vienna that weekend to visit the Spanish Riding School. Hofreitschule, he said. The Royal Spanish Riding Hall. Hofreitschule, I corrected myself. Herr Hartmann, before you go any further, do you mind my asking your age? I dithered between repeating my correct name or stating my age. 42, I said. Haha, then I'm twice as old as you. I'm 84. After congratulating him on his seniority, I started talking about the Lipizzaners. What intrigued me most was the idea of their nobility, a human-bred animal that resided on the top rung of racial enhancement. If anyone could tell me about the background of this imperial horse, he could. Brabenitz listened for a minute, then asked, "Have you ever been a soldier?" I had to admit I hadn't. "Then it's going to be difficult. If you've never served in the army, how can I explain things to you?" "I've been in wars," I said, "in the Balkans and in the Caucasus." "Ah, ich auch," I heard him say. "Also in the Balkans and almost in the Caucasus. We landed in the Crimea, 1942, but never got further than the Kerch Peninsula." He paused, then asked, "Gavarice Paruski?" I replied in Russian. Brabenitz growled, "I used to speak it. You see, I spent 2.5 years as a Soviet prisoner of war. We learned Armee Russis. But you know what? If you call me on Sunday, once you get to Vienna, I'll let you know whether I can receive you on Monday."
And that's one of many rather wonderful characters that stream through this book. Can you just start answering one very factual question? This riding school is in Vienna. Why is it called the Spanish Riding School?
That dates back 4 centuries. Actually, the emperor, the Austrian emperor, decided to have his own horse breed. And he asked his equerries to create one. He wanted to have the best genetic horse material available. And they brought in Andalusian horses from Spain to start with. So the first imperial stud farm in the village of Lipizzan near the Adriatic started off with Spanish horses. That's why it's called the Spanish Riding School.
It is very anecdotal, this account, but is also actually very serious at its heart. It's one of those things where wonderful, fortuitous histories where you pick on one object or perhaps a commodity and then you find that it tells some sort of a history of the world. And in this case, it's the story of eugenics, basically, isn't it?
Yes, apparently it's all about horses. A special breed of horses, the Lipizzaners, the famous ones from Vienna, dancing in the Spanish Riding School, even today. But of course I use the history or the fate of the Lipizzaner horses as a prism or as a metaphor, if you want. You could say it's a fable, non-fiction fable, but like all animal stories, they're about us, human beings.
It is quite an extreme story, isn't it? There are only 6 stallion lines, as you find out from Herr Brebens, among other people, that carry the true blood of the Lipizzaner with them.
Oh yeah, the breed is very narrow. After the First World War, there were only 1,000 Lipizzaner horses, and their forefathers were only 6 stallions. And so the breed is very limited, very small. But they were the living crown jewels of the empire. And in the interbellum, after the First World War, they were there for grabs. So they were so prestigious that Hitler wanted to have them. Later on, Marshal Tito tried to get a chunk. Before that, Mussolini actually got his part of the Lipizzaner herd. And even Ceausescu, in his days, had his share. And they all tried their breeding experiments on this troop of pedigree horses.
So what is so special genetically? You talk about their fluidity, and it's got something to do with the 13th vertebra, or what happens beyond the 13th vertebra.
Well, actually, the Lipizzaner horse was created to carry the emperor. So they wanted to have an animal that was graceful, strong, but also intelligent. And it should perform, parade, show off. Actually, with crossbreeding and selection over 400 years, they brought these characteristics together in one single horse, the Lipizzaner. And one of the features is that between the 13th and the 14th vertebra, the Lipizzaner horse is more flexible. So it can do this, perform this levade, which is rearing, but then in a controlled way, to greet the emperor. As if a general comes back from the battlefield triumphantly, he would go into the levade on his Lipizzaner stallion, and a Lipizzaner can perform the levade better than any other horse because of this inbred flexibility.
How is that different from the Arab horse, which you point out has one fewer ribs than anybody else? Is this that's also been bred in, presumably?
No, that's a natural feature, because the feral Equus ferus, the wild horse from the steppe, is completely different from the horse Equus caballus that we know today. Actually, Equus caballus, the horse itself, has 2 chromosomes less than its feral ancestor. I try to point out that the horse was not created by God. It's not a product of Darwin's evolution. It was man-made, created, cultivated by selection and crossbreeding over the centuries. And before that, domestication. And so if you go, if you take a view from a distance and you see the Lipizzaner that is performing in the Spanish Riding Hall, the most beautiful manege on earth, on music, that's 12 years of training, 400 years of breeding, and 6,000 of domestication.
Now, as you suggested when you mentioned Hitler, it does have its sinister side. And you, one of the pieces of evidence you find is of school textbooks from Nazi Germany, which make an overt connection between horse breeding and people breeding.
There are many connections, because, of course, what the horse breeders did and achieved was so fantastic. You could create a white stallion that could dance on classical music. Of course, when the turn of the 20th century, at the beginning of the 20th century, all of a sudden the idea of heredity, the fundamentals of genetics were uncovered. Politicians, the Nazi regime, the fascism, banked on it, and they thought we could apply biology to politics, which is one of the definitions of Nazism, and we could enhance the human race, the Aryan race. We could purify the German race to filter out the so-called bad genes of Jews and Gypsies and Slavs, and recreate the Nordic type of German, the Aryan type. And they took the model from horse breeders, actually, which is very striking. I start to tell the story about one particular stallion that I've known, and when I was young, I was riding at the riding school. And this Lipizzaner stallion has, of course, its pedigree, and it's written there who his parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents are. And if you look at textbooks in biology in the 30s in Nazi Germany, you have a biology book, and in the end, every pupil is asked to fill out his own pedigree, like that of a horse. So you have your parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, but you also had to fill in the color of their hair, the color of their eyes. And it's chilling if you see that this happened just before the Second World War. It's like, I mean, if your blood is not pure enough, this could be your death sentence. If you have Jewish ancestry or features that were disliked, that had to be, by negative eugenics, be filtered out of the people, the folk.
There are several wonderful ironies in this story, and one of them is that these Lipizzaner horses, although they turn white, are born black, and that every now and then one of them stays black. 10% of them stay black. So wouldn't that have been a bit of a problem for Hitler?
The thing is that horse breeding was an art up till the 20th century. So yes, one of the forefathers was a black horse. The Conversano horses that I follow within the Lipizzaner family was a black horse. His offspring is greys, white horses. And the foals, yes, they're all born black or brown. And now in every 150, you have one foal that stays black or brown for the rest of his or her life. And the horse breeders didn't know why this happened. And they tried to preserve the colored ones. And they couldn't. They were at a loss why the greys would dominate. And it was only after Brother Mendel discovered the fundamental laws of genetics that they understood that you had a carrier of a certain strain, of a certain characteristic, that was not necessarily had to express itself. And that the carriers were passed on in reproduction rather than the characteristics itself. The carriers were independent of whether or not it would be expressed. So this is genetics, but they were at a loss. And there are many ironies and many contradictions, because if you look at the Lipizzaner horse, it is fundamentally a bastard. You bring all kinds of races of horse breeds together and you create a new species. You call it a pure-blooded horse. It's racial purity that counts in the pedigree of a Lipizzaner horse. That is valued very much. I like to focus also on these contradictions, because yes, Hitler, being an Austrian, took pride of getting hold of the Spanish riding school in Vienna. He not only annexed his country of birth and included it in the Great Reich, but he tried to get hold of all the Lipizzaners, also the mares, from different stud farms and collected them in Heartland Germany. Because, yes, they were showing off the Körperkultur, these movements, gymnastics that he was fond of, and most of all because they embodied racial purity.
Now, there's another irony, which is that the inbreeding means that actually they have quite a high rate of birth defects, don't they? Yeah. What did he make of that?
That's the other contradiction. The gene pool of the Lipizzaner horses is so limited that there is a lot of cases of inbreeding. Especially when the Danube Empire fell apart and new countries appeared on the map, the stud farms had no way of interchanging their stallions anymore. So you got this problem of inbreeding, so foals were born with no gender at all, defunct animals that were brought to the butcher. So you have considered to be the most noble breed, like in royal families, in the aristocracy, you had these defunct individuals. I mean, the heir to the throne of the Romanovs, the Tsar, had hemophilia because of inbreeding in the Romanov family. So the best families, considered to be the best families, had this problem of inbreeding, as had the horses. There are so many similarities between horse breeding and the human quest for nobility, for creating better humans, superhumans. That is basically what fascinated me most. I'm not a historian. The 20th century as a subject is too big for me. But by sticking to telling the story of the fate of 1,000 Lipizzaners that are orphaned after the First World War, that have been deported, stolen, slaughtered, put to experimental breeding experiments by both Hitler and Stalin, will tell in an indirect way, I think, a lot about us humans and our failure to improve morally.
So my name is Vic Armstrong, and I'm going to talk about my book, which is The Adventures of the World's Greatest Stuntman. Rather pretentious, but it's my life as Indiana Jones, James Bond and Superman. And it's basically my career in films over the last 45 years as a stuntman.
Okay, so Vic, there's a controversial statement, my life as Indiana Jones.
Absolutely. It's one of the genres that I'm really proud to have worked on. It was such an iconic figure, Indiana Jones. You know, I did Superman 1 and 2 with Christopher Reeve, and I've done seven or eight Bonds. But out of all of them, I think Indiana Jones was the greatest, you know. When you make movies, you never know if they're going to be big or they're going to be small flops or failures or hits. And when we made Raiders, we didn't know what the heck it was going to be. But I do remember going up to Leicester Square, the Odeon Leicester Square, where we always have our cast and crew screenings. And I took five or six kids, friends' kids and my kids. And suddenly during the movie, I noticed all the kids were standing on the seats going, "Go on, Indy!" And you think, oh, okay, you know, this will attack kids. And then, of course, it's a huge success. And then you do the second one, it's a big success. So by the time we got round to The Last Crusade, you know you're actually on a decent winning wicket, if you like. It's much more fun that way. It takes a lot of the worry out of movies.
I was talking to a filmy friend of mine who was terribly excited that I was going to meet you tomorrow, and he said, what you've got to get him to tell you is how all the film stars lie about doing their own stunts. And you've got a big section here about Tom Cruise doing his own stunts, and he said, get him to admit that Tom Cruise didn't do his own stunts.
There's no way I could say that, because he does. I go back to Legend with Ridley Scott when it was like Tom's second movie, and that was horse riding. We taught him to ride. Then you cut to Mission Impossible, War of the Worlds and stuff like that. Well, during that period and working with him on War of the Worlds, I realised how physical he was, and I did design everything that Tom could do. We had a sequence in China, in Shanghai, where he jumps off this 800-foot building on a wire and swings and smashes in through a window and all that sort of stuff, which we didn't do on the building. You get the impression it was on the building, but we built various set pieces, one of which was in Universal Studios on top of the Curious George car park, which is a huge car park which overlooks the amusement park. And he was about 80 feet in the air, and he has to run. We had the top of the set built there, a building, and Tom has to run and leap into space and fall about 60, 70 feet before the restrainer kicks in and starts slowing him down. And Tom, we rehearsed it like we always do. We always rehearse it with the stuntman, and then Tom comes in, I explain the shot to him, and he says, okay, let's go. Put the harness on him, hook him up. I said, do you want to see a video of it? No, that's fine, that's it. And we have a sort of a route marked on the ground with camera tape. I said, all right, run along that route and then kick off into space. And he just ran and launched himself, and I guarantee 19 out of 20 people would be timid. Even if they did have the guts to jump off, they'd be very timid jumping off. He just launched himself into space. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but it's he does his own stunts. You see him a tanker jackknife and go over the top of him. I tested it myself because I was a bit worried about it, and it's a special rig tanker that we steer with the back wheels. But I lay under it, and if I stretch my arms out, there's about 18 inches fingertip to wheel either side of my arms, because they don't go completely like that. They go at a diagonal, so it's not 30-foot gap, it's now down to about 17 feet because of the angle of the trailer. And Tom did that, you know. He is amazing. He guaranteed does all his own stunts. He's phenomenal.
Now, there are some anecdotes you tell where actually it was dangerous, not because of what was happening on set, but because of what was happening off set, notably on the set of The Mission.
Yes, The Mission. I think that's one of the wonderful things about my side of the business, or my life in this business. I've always done probably 80% of my work has been on location, and more often than not, more in the earlier days than now, those locations were wild and woolly, crazy places, and The Mission was no exception. That was absolutely phenomenal. We started off in Cartagena in Colombia, which is a notoriously rough place anyway. Then we moved up to Santa Marta, which is an area where 95% of the drugs come out of Colombia to go into the States and everywhere else in the world. And we had one night we came to work, our night watchman had his throat cut. Another day we were driving to work, and the convoy we were in, we had a police escort, was stopped on a bridge because somebody had been executed through the back of the head. And this happened three consecutive days, from one family to another family to another family. And I was pretty hard on my stunt crew, because I trained up a load of local boys in Santa Marta, deadbeats and rough lads, but I wanted them to be these mercenary characters chasing after Robert De Niro. And I trained them up, and they were very grateful for the work. And I was hard on them, made them work hard, because if you weren't, they were doped out of their brains by 10 o'clock in the morning. And anyway, one morning, two of the kids, who I was very worried about using anyway, because they looked too young and innocent, I wanted these hard-looking faces, they weren't there. So I went ballistic, and then somebody said, oh, Joe's not here, because he's at a funeral. And I said, oh, whose funeral? He said, his brother's. His brother, who's working with us, said, I don't know, they'd got into a shouting match with some police one night, and the police wanted to take them in to the station. They knew they'd be in trouble if they did, so they ran, and the police shot him and killed him. the following night, the policeman's family were all murdered, you know. So it's that sort of living. It was quite exciting.
But you borrowed horses from a drug baron, is that true, for that film? So the horses we've seen on that film were actually criminal horses.
Well, maybe they were bought with criminal proceedings, but they were lovely horses.
And your filmography, which you have listed at the back, is really quite astonishing. It took me about 10 minutes to count them. There's something like 146 films.
There's probably twice that many as well. They're not all in there. In the early years, you'd have a month or two off between films. But when I was really, you know, making fast progress in the 70s, 80s, 90s, I would literally finish on a Friday night and then fly to Mexico, for argument's sake, on a Saturday morning and work 3-4 months there and fly from there straight to another location. You know, I had a period where I wasn't in England at all for maybe 1-2 weeks out of the year. Been like that for years and years and years.
Vic, in this podcast, we've just heard from Frank Vesterman about the Lipizzaners. You also have a connection with them.
I certainly do. As a young kid, my dad's great friend was Alois Podaisky, and he was the gentleman that hid the horses from the Germans during the war. He took them across the mountains and stashed them away so the Germans couldn't get to them. And their very, very first tour outside of Vienna after the war, they came and stayed at our stables in Farnham Common. And Dad was friendly with Podaisky from that moment onwards. And I can remember him until I was in my nearly 30s. And he was in his 70s, was a ramrod straight back. I've got a book at home signed by Colonel Podaisky to my father, you know, thanking him for everything over the years and everything else. So it's very, very close to my heart.
Don't you Brits feel like celebrating those 14 days of sporting glory? Of course you do. So why not do it with a strictly unofficial but suitably stylish Philosophy Football Design t-shirt? This unique t-shirt is a wearable, chronological, and color-coded record of an unforgettable fortnight. And for Guardian and Observer podcast fans, we have a special offer of £3 off and free post and packaging. Curious? Well, to see how good this unique t-shirt looks and to take advantage of our listeners' offer, just go to guardian.co.uk/podcast offers. I dare you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.